Eminent persons usually stand out from their families, their peers, their hometowns, their own children. The eminent are usually different, unlike their closest kin, nature, and their milieu, nurture. That is, neither genes nor environment can be surely shown to determine eminence. The striking individuality of the eminent, who we suppose represent or partake in creativity, however it be defined, is not attributed either to nature or to nurture. Something else? An independent factor? To avoid parsing out the something else and declaring for an independent factor, behavioral explanations blend nature and nurture. They propose a mysterious weaving of black and white threads, whose result is so subtly entwined that we are confronted with a gray screen of uncertainty as to whether creativity is preponderantly genetic or environmental. In place of the eternal enigma of human creativity, this gray explanation offers less risk of shaking the two-party system with the introduction of a truly different component, the calling proposed by the acorn theory. It also offers less satisfaction to the imaginative mind. If creativity shows little genetic influence, traditionalism, surprisingly, seems rather strongly inherited. The research uses the term traditionalism for the tendency to follow rules and authority and to endorse high moral standards and strict discipline. The data are apolitical, as science must pretend to be, and so genetic traditionalism is not directly associated with actual political, republican, or religious, fundamentalist, orthodox, positions. Yet the description of traditionalism does suggest some genetic wiring at the core of conservative, even reactionary, party and church affiliations. Jerome Kagan's judicious studies of innate character might speak of temperamental bias. Astrology might imagine Saturn as an influence on the chromosomes. Feminism might despairingly realize how immovable patriarchal attitudes are. Marxists might understand why it is so hard to awaken the peasants and proletariat to revolution. And the church might take comfort. There will always be a genetic pool ready to flow uphill toward the Vatican. Some 40 years ago, the anthropologist Paul Radin gave an explanation for the rise of monotheism. He said it was not a natural stage in the development of religions. Rather, monotheistic thinking belonged to a priestly caste and caste of mind. Monotheism, he said, originates in a particular temperament. He intuitively foresaw the determining role of the traditionalist attitude in character before genetics came up with the data about traditionalism. It becomes easier to see why it is so difficult to bring about change. Perhaps traditionalism is the conservative streak in human nature that appears as fundamentalism and single-mindedness in any culture, personified by the archetypal figure of the old king. I find it a relief to know that holding the line with high moral standards and strict discipline is not necessarily the policy of the angel or the voice of a calling, but belongs to your frame like your skull and bones. Assuming, then, that traditionalism has a strong genetic component, does this help to understand why the genius calls away from the traditional life? For many centuries, from the Problemata of Aristotle on melancholic frenzy, or furor, the exceptional mental state of creative people, through Cesare Lombroso in the 19th century, calling is compared with, even identified with, the untraditional and abnormal. People like to imagine that novelty and originality are non-traditional, as if inspiration must by definition oppose order, discipline, rules, and authority, that is, traditionalism. At least we may hazard the conclusion that there can be strong conflict between conservative genetic attitudes and something else that calls against and away. A third intriguing finding says that the influence of heredity on intelligence, IQ measurements, increases after infancy, up to the middle years of childhood. In fact, the evidence seems to say that the heritability of IQ rises as one ages, all the way from early childhood to late adulthood. I would have thought that the genetic factor would be strongest and most determining of one's abilities, such as intelligence, at first entry into the world, before a person is bombarded by impacts from the outer world and able to select among them. I would have believed the early months and years to be when the genetic factors play the largest role. Yet findings in regard to the IQ of children show that as a child gets older, from age 3 to 6 or 7, heritability increases. It then begins to subside again after about age 7. Furthermore, IQ scores increase substantially during childhood, even though IQ was strongly correlated with heritability. We shall discuss the IQ issue in a moment. Why is the heredity factor less compelling at age 2 or 3 than at 7 or 8? Is the individuality of intelligence more pronounced at birth, gradually to wane in middle childhood? The finding could suggest that an infant is less under the influence of both nature and nurture than an older child is, and more indebted, at least in regard to native intelligence, to his or her own original gift. This reading of the data would support the Platonic myth that a person is born with an innate paradigm that is not identical with genetic endowment, and that gradually gives way in middle childhood as genetic factors kick in. Moreover, in late adulthood, when calling, character, and fate have become more inescapable, then too one's intelligence and all that it serves belongs more to the code of the soul than to that of the genes. Heritability appears to decline in early adolescence also. This is as we might expect. Many biographies bear witness to the sudden surprise of calling during the teen years. In other words, calling seems closest during the years 3 through 8, and then again during adolescence. That is, if we imagine calling to be more evident when genetic influences recede. Some of the life stories in these chapters do show the daimon appearing in the early years and in adolescence. Speculations such as these are the frothy part of empirical and statistical studies. They make reading the literature fun. Taken straight, statistical studies stone the mind. So I present the findings not as they are presented to me, as evidence to harden the concrete. I offer them to spark speculation. Such speculation becomes even more important as the sciences of both molecular biology and statistics sophisticate, and as the samples broaden. The imagination must expand to keep up with the data. 11,000 identical twin pairs are born in the United States each year. It becomes ever clearer that genetic influences are intensely complex and varied, even if we wish to plot them mechanistically or trap them under a bell curve. With this, we have landed in the IQ briar patch. Although the issue of genetic influence on IQ scores has traditionally been one of the most controversial areas in the behavioral sciences, a recent survey of over 1,000 scientists and educators indicates that most now believe individual differences in IQ scores are at least partially inherited. Do notice the word I emphasized, individual. Differences, not of gender, not of color, not of race, not of class, not of any group, but between individuals. So I want to fault the comparison of IQ scores of so-called blacks and whites in at least four ways. 1. Who, genetically, is black and who white in our 350-year-old miscegenated culture? To say nothing of genetic mixing long before the Americas were invaded by Europeans and their imported Africans. 2. What are we actually scoring in IQ tests that is called IQ? 3. What is the psychological meaning of test in various social communities, and the relation between an IQ test as a ritual and other test rituals? 4. Besides these questions, which can be found in the endless arguments about IQ and its scores and tests, there is one that derives particularly from this book. If there is an acorn or daimon, and if this factor often resists compliance with socialization, as the stories of the eminent often show, could such resistance frustrate IQ test achievement? Would it not perhaps single out especially the IQ tests for its refusals, since high IQ scores are generally the right passport into a more acceptable part of the bell curve? Individuality. The individual identity of each human person is not only an article of religious faith or an axiom of the Western mind. Human individuality is also a statistical quasi-certainty. Each of us has the capacity to generate 10 to the power of 3,000 eggs or sperm with unique sets of genes. If we consider 10 to the power of 3,000 possible eggs being generated by an individual woman, and the same number of sperm being generated by an individual man, the likelihood of anyone else with your set of genes in the past or in the future becomes infinitesimal. Moreover, genetic research itself warns that the genes cannot be grasped by simplistic explanations. The timing of their interventions occurs in spurts and lags. Their interrelation with environmental circumstances is infinitely involved. So research since the 1980s has focused more and more on separate lives, behavioral differences, non-shared orientations, or what you and I would call individuality. To account for the genetic aspect of individuality, three theories have been growing in importance. These explanatory ideas, too, point toward something else. The first is called emergenesis. It is based in part on the startling data of genetic traits that do not run in families, yet appear in the tastes, styles, and idiosyncratic habits of identical twins reared apart. Here are some examples of this amazing concordance in separately raised twins. A pair of male MZAs, monozygotic adults, at their first adult reunion, discovered that they both used Betty Macomb toothpaste, Canoe shaving lotion, Vitalis hair tonic, and Lucky Strike cigarettes. After that meeting, they exchanged birthday presents that crossed in the mail and proved to be identical choices, made independently in separate cities. There were two gunsmith hobbyists among the group of twins, two women who habitually wore seven rings, two who obsessively counted things, two who had been married 5 times, two captains of volunteer fire departments, two fashion designers, two who left little love notes around the house for their wives, in each case, an MZA pair. The dizygotic, separated in infancy and reared apart, DZA twins, whom we have studied, in contrast, seldom produced similar coincidences. Emergenesis accounts for these convergent phenomena by saying that the similarities must be A, genetic in origin, because they appear in identical twins, and B, the result of a configuration of genes emergent uniquely in this or that particular pair. If these habits and tastes appeared in any single person, we would have no evidence of genetic influence. But since these habits and tastes appear in identical twins reared apart, the concordance can be due only to inheritance. Emergenesis says that the genetic material results in a unique configuration, inherited from the gene stuff of both parental lines. You might receive the 10 and King of Spades from Dad, and the Jack, Queen, and Ace of Spades from Mom, cards that had never counted for much in either family tree, but whose combination in you might produce a new Olympic record. It is not just a pile of genetic stuff that makes for uniqueness, but the way your hand of cards fills out and forms a particular and successful configuration. Our term for configuration was pattern or image, the particular paradigma that is your lot according to Plato's myth. Emergenesis accounts genetically, and I suppose randomly, for the paradigm that is yours. For who knows what makes you draw a winning hand? Or rather, the fates know. Your configuration is the lot your soul chose before you ever took a breath. The second theoretical idea goes by the name of epistasis. It refers to the inhibitory effect of genes acting on one another in a staggering variety of combinations. Behavioral differences among individuals involve many genes, perhaps hundreds. Each of these genes can make its own small, independent contribution to the variability among individuals. Epistasis is like genetic luck. Luck of the draw at conception can result in certain unique combinations of genes that have extraordinary effects not seen in parents or siblings. An unpredictable luck of the draw plays its part in who we are. In Plato, this random cause was named Ananke, the formidable goddess of necessity. She defied reason and, in Plato's myth, governed the lots our souls selected. And it was called Tyche and Moira, who are personifications of fate. From Roman times into the Renaissance, this principle was called Fortuna. And it does seem odd to come, finally, to these archetypal figures to account for an individual's specific character and destiny, as if we knew it all the time, except that now we have a new name for it, chaos theory, the third idea now prominent in studies of heredity. In nonlinear systems, and surely a life is a nonlinear system, tiny, seemingly trivial differences in input can lead to huge differences in output. Chaotic systems are not predictable, and surely unpredictability too is a characteristic of life, but they are stable in their irregular patterns. Chaos theory gives great importance to sensitive dependence on initial conditions. Have we not come home to the influence of the angel or genius and the seemingly trivial, yet highly significant ways it works, like Tiny Yehudi Menuhin's temper tantrum over the toy violin, like Ella Fitzgerald's sudden shift to singing on Amateur Night? I draw your attention further to the introductory phrase, in non-linear systems. We cannot think of our biographies only as time-bound, as a progression along a line from birth to death. This is only one dimension, the temporal one, a linear one. The soul moves in circles, said Plotinus. Hence our lives are not moving straight ahead. Instead, hovering, wavering, returning, renewing, repeating. The genes work in lags and spurts. The sense of being in the zone, in touch, opened out, blasted. Seeing and knowing comes and goes utterly unpredictably, yet with stable patterns. I am different from everyone else, and the same as everyone else. I am different from myself 10 years ago, and the same as myself 10 years ago. My life is a stable chaos, chaotic and repetitive both. And I can never predict what tiny, trivial bit of input will result in a huge and significant output. I must always remain acutely sensitive to initial conditions, such as what or who came into the world with me, and enters the world with me each day. On that I remain dependent. Love. We seem not as unique in our loving as we might like to believe. People seem to have similar styles of loving. Adult identical twins show this similarity most clearly, for they tend to conceive of love in the same way. By styles of loving, I am referring to the models used in love research. The broad concept love is sorted into a variety of baskets, such as responsible, altruistic caretaking, agape, practical partnership, pragma, erotic intimacy, eros, and so on. Identical twins converge in these categories, yet the reason for the similarity is not genetic. The findings from this first behavior genetic analysis of adult love styles are remarkable for two reasons. First, we know of no personality domain, stress tolerance, aggression, control, etc., in which genetic factors play such a small role. Second, we are aware of no attitude, religious beliefs, race, biases, etc., in which genetic factors play such a small role. Now here is a happy curiosity. These twins are in accord in all love styles except for one. Mania, the obsessive, tormented feeling usually characteristic of romantic love. So we have to inquire into why the exception of manic romantic love. In this specific regard, there seems to be an independence of the heart. Manic love is something else. Since the explanation for the similarity of styles is not genetic, the research model allows only one alternative: environment. Look-alike twins who love alike have picked up identical love maps. Love maps are one of the ways psychology tries to account for the mysteries of being seized by love. You grow up in a parental environment where certain features bring pleasure, meet needs, enhance vitality. These characteristics form a schema that you fall for when a person crosses your path who seems to have the attributes of the love map. As you grow up, this unconscious map takes shape, and a composite proto-image of the ideal sweetheart gradually emerges. So long before your true love walks past you in a classroom, at a shopping mall, or in the office, you have already constructed some basic elements of your ideal sweetheart. The love map consists of layers. Cross-cultural research claims that there is a collective level for love maps in general, such as a good complexion. In women, bodies that are plump and wide-hipped are universally attractive. In men, worldly goods such as cars or camels. Then there are layers reflecting traditions, fashions, and local community norms. The theory of love maps suggests that environmental conditioning determines the object of your desire. Other psychologists call this object choice a projection. According to Jungian psychology, the projection springs from an archetypal source as part of each soul's intimate essence. For Jungians, the love map has highly individualized features, because it is a complex image in the heart that brings about the fall and the feeling that this is a call of fate. The more obsessive and compelling the image, the more madly in love you become, which intensifies the conviction that, indeed, fate is calling. Jungians name this archetypal factor that skews the love map toward a particular person the anima and animus. These figures may bear surface traits of the love map, but can't be reduced to it. Anima and animus originate in the Latin words for soul and spirit. So your heart may fall for a composite childhood image, but always an unknown configuration is structuring your map and permeating it with experiences of miracle and mystery. That's why, Jungians would say, love is so overwhelming. It knocks your socks off, as it lifts you right out of your shoes and out of this world. The experience of romantic love is beyond all conditions, claiming devotion beyond all bounds. For Plato, mania was an intervention of the gods, specifically Aphrodite and Eros. Little else in life feels more exclusively meant for me, more personally directed at you, than the manic moment of romance. Romance feels fateful, feels like kismet, karma, destiny. It had to be you. Nobody else would do. Only you. I wandered around, finally found, you are my lucky star. This fatal attraction, impersonally called chemistry, and attached to subliminal pheromones, has its autonomy of force apart from both genetics and environment. Whether this feeling be delusional or not, it provides convincing witness to what the Jungians are claiming with their interpretation of romantic love, something meant, something else that is particularly romantic accompanies the phenomenon. Of course, identical twins lose some of their sameness by falling differently. So we have seen two ways of imagining the love map, the Jungian, anima animus, and the nature or nurture model. According to the latter, romantic love styles are not strongly influenced by heritable factors. The only possible alternative is the environment. You learned your style of love during early years. How? Unique experiences, on the one hand, and, on the other, perhaps sharing parents and making similar observations of parents' relational styles. Perhaps. The thesis assumes that you fall in love, if not directly with your parents, as Freudianism implies, then with surrogates for them, or at least following their patterns. Again, the parental fallacy is brought into account for what is not understood. Whether I want a girl just like the girl who married dear old dad, or a girl as different from her as possible, it is a great leap of faith and an insult to the person for whom my heart has fallen to believe that my fantasies and styles of love replicate mom and dad, except on the collective, socialized level of the map. For Jungians, mom and dad are preview images of the anima and animus. Even if we do imitate mom and dad and their style of loving, we're not photocopies. Fantasy embellishes the map, or more likely, designs it. Empirical studies of romantic love declare that romantic love is inexorably tied up with fantasy. Idealization is essential to it, not imitation, not replication of the known, expectation of the unknown. Some details of parental manners of relating suit, others are never reproduced, and the factors that spin the fantasy and select the details are anima and animus. The archetypal fantasies integrate whatever maps we pick up from mom and dad, and not the other way around. There can be other causes than family styles for similarities between twins. Twins may seek to replicate the relationship they have with each other. That stability, that friendship, that practicality and caring, and unconscious egg-given physical closeness, transferring to a mate what has been their lifestyle so far. Kissing and fighting go on in the womb. Replication alone might give them similar love maps, but the object of our search is less the reason for their similarity than their difference regarding manic romantic love, that condition of torment and desperate need, of highs and lows, of obsessive dependency, a condition you seem never able to get over. Another reason for dissimilarity in romantic styles of twins is the need for a psychological mirror, which romantic love provides. In the mirror of similarity, we see only our twin face. In the mirror of mania, we see something altogether other, the face that we cannot find, do not know. And that seems to require a romantic agony. If monozygotic identity is laid down in your DNA and reinforced with every shared environmental breath, it takes wrenching distortion to bring about difference. The love map may account for visibilities like those fluid hips, those cars or camels, but love falls also for something else, invisible. We say, there's something about her. The whole world changes in his presence. As Flaubert supposedly said, she was the focal point of light at which the totality of things converged. This is off the map altogether. We are in the terrain of transcendence, where usual realities hold less conviction than invisibilities. If ever we wanted obvious proof of the daimon and its calling, we need but fall once in love. The rational sources of heredity and environment are not enough to give rise to the torrents of romantic agony. It's all you. And never do you feel more flooded with importance and more destined. Nor can what you do turn out to be more demonic. This intoxication with self-importance suggests that romantic love has in fact promoted the growth of individuality. According to Susan and Clyde Hendrick, it can be well argued that the Western sense of person parallels the place given to romantic love in the culture, as shown first by courtly romance and the troubadours, and then in the Renaissance. Ideals of individualism and individual destiny reached an apogee in the 19th century, as did the delirious exaggerations of romantic love, so that, as the Hendricks say, romantic love may be construed as a force or device to help create or enhance self and individuality. These psychodynamics must locate the call of love within the personal self. My psychodaimonics imagines this call more phenomenologically, using the language that love itself uses, myth, poetry, story, and song, and that places the call beyond the self, as if it comes from a divine or demonic being. That's why the manic style of romantic love doesn't converge with the other maps of loving. Calling crystallizes in that person whose face calls you to what feels like your fate. That person becomes a divinity exteriorized, master of my fate, mistress of my soul, as the romantics say, both demonic and angelic, the one I must cling to and cannot part from, not because I am so weak, but because it, the call, the destiny, is so strong. Of course, I am tormented, possessive, dependent, in pain. The daimon is shredding my love map. Identical twins may choose the same aftershave and toothpaste, but the most important choice of all, that of a mate, seems to be an exception. Romantic infatuation forms almost adventitiously. Behavioral science concludes that human pairing is inherently random. It retreats to the statistical luck of the draw to account for the most important choice of all, because psychology as a science dares not imagine what it cannot measure. We can, however, read the recent research as support for the autonomy of the genius. Its fire lights up precisely the companion required, for better or worse, for long term or short, convincing me that this other is a one and only, and this event is unique. The other styles of loving charted in the research, sharing, caring, practical commitments, and libidinal intimacy, are less selective, less personal. They do not insist upon this particular partner who embodies the image I carry in my heart. Romantic mania sees what is already there in the acorn before you even came along. The Spanish philosopher Ortega y Gasset says we fall in love on few occasions in a long life. It is a rare and fortuitous event, and it strikes incredibly deeply. When such love happens, it is for no other reason than the singularity of the object, only this person. Not attributes and virtues, not voice or hips or bank account, not projections left over from earlier flames or hand-me-down family patterns. Simply the uniqueness of this person whom the heart's eye selected. Without that sense of fate in the choice, the romance of the love doesn't work. For this sort of love is not a personal relationship or a genetic epistasis, but more likely a daimonic inheritance, a gift and curse from the invisible ancestors. A similar sense of destiny, if less sudden and less heated, and a similar devotion can mark falling for a place and even for a work, as well as for a person. You can't leave it. You must stay with it until it's over. You perform ritual magic devotions to keep it going. The same enchantments occur. The same sense arises that I could live the rest of my life with you, whether you is a person, a place, a work. And the similar feeling exists that not only is my life called here, but my death. Death is a ponderous and repugnant term to connect with the intense vibrations of romantic love. But romantic love especially reverberates with feelings of both the eternal and the shortness and fragility of life, as if death's call to a limitless beyond elsewhere were always shadowing and inspiring romantic passion. One takes the most extraordinary risks, and when literature joins romantic lovers, it also joins their love with death. The eye of the heart that sees is also the eye of death that sees through visible presentation to an invisible core. When Michelangelo sculpted portraits of his contemporaries, or of the figures of religion and myth, he attempted to see what he called the imagina del cuore, the heart's image, a prefiguration of what he was sculpting, as if the chisel that cut the rock followed the eye that penetrated his subject into its heart. The portrait aimed to reveal the inner soul of what he was carving. A heart's image lies within each person. It is what we truly reveal when we fall helplessly in love, for then we are opened to display who we most truly are, giving a glimpse of our soul's genius. People say, "He looks so different. He must be in love. She's fallen in love. She's utterly changed." When love moves the heart, something else is perceived in the idolized object, which poetic language tries to capture. Michelangelo tried to express this image in the sculpted form. The categories of nature and nurture do not reach into the heart or see through its eye. That is why we have had to add to our examination of genetics and environment this coda on love. The meeting between lover and beloved is heart to heart, like that between sculptor and model, between hand and stone. It is a meeting of images, an exchange of imaginations. When we fall in love, we begin to imagine romantically, fiercely, wildly, madly, jealously, with possessive, paranoid intensity. And when we imagine strongly, we begin to fall in love with the images conjured before the heart's eye, as when starting a project, preparing a vacation trip, planning a new house in a different city, swelling with pregnancy. Our imaginations draw us ever more fully into the venture. You can't leave the lab, can't stop buying equipment, reading brochures, imagining names. You are in love because of imagination. By freeing imagination, even identical twins are freed of their sameness. Environment. Before we leave this chapter, we must go back again to our own set of twins, nature and nurture, aka environment. Since environment is the concept that the two major themes of this chapter, genetics and love, employ to explain the obscure grounds of difference, we can't allow the term to go unexamined. The unusual and little used verb to environ means surround, enclose, envelop, literally to form a ring around. Environment, the noun, means a set of circumstances, circum, around, the context, the physical conditions, and external situations that surround our persons and our lives. The research on twins divides environment into two main kinds, shared and unshared. To have a shared environment in general means to have been raised in the same family around the clock for some years, partaking in the family's activities, values, conversations, habits. To have sat in the same classrooms with the same teachers. To have struggled with the same coaches and teammates. The image of a shared environment is, of course, idealized, and rather resembles a 50s white world movie. Unshared environment refers to the singular experiences of each twin alone. What is unshared must include chance occurrences and illnesses, and the feelings, dreams, thoughts, and relationships that are personal and private. Can we draw a line sharply between shared and unshared? The actual shared environment is jam-packed with differences. How the mother differentiates each of an identical pair of twins, how each develops its own parental relationships, differences in care during postnatal hospitalization, which is often necessary in twin births, health complications in infancy, physical positions in cradle and crib, and at the breast, and so on. Especially important is the difference between members of the identical pair in their relations with each other, where they are governed by an archetypal logic of complementarity. Weaker, stronger, smarter, dumber, first, last, extrovert, introvert, earthly, heavenly, mortal, immortal, and so on. Besides, researchers note that between twins within a shared competitive environment, a rivalry develops that yields unshared, individualized responses in each. Rivalry results not only from the competitive ethos of our culture. It reflects the innate urge of sames to differentiate their identities. Each person seeks to be an each in conformity with his or her heart's image, and the path of its destiny despite genetics, despite environment. Every family is a hearth of similarities and a centrifugal force whirling each member to competitively assert his or her differences. In the case of identical twins, the very pull for closeness pushes them apart. Magnets that cling together at one pole mutually repel at the other. Let's attribute differences not merely to competitive rivalry, but also to the angel's call to a unique fate. The idea of environment needs even further analysis. It surely goes beyond images of the family network, a simple sitcom set of similar jokes and squabbles, similar snacks from the fridge, similar bedtimes. The environment is also the furniture and the pickup, the pets, and the plants on the windowsill. It extends outside the walls to the yard and the neighbors, to the action in the street, to what is produced thousands of miles away and comes in via TV, internet, and Walkman. It must also include the supermarket, which packages and shelves the world, bananas from Ecuador and fish from Newfoundland, and also the chemical coatings on the bananas and the traces of mercury washed from pulp mills into the cells of the fish. Once we have opened the ecological eye, where does environment, even immediate, unshared, private, individual environment, stop? Can, in fact, there be an unshared environment? Can I truly possess a shut-off moment that is all mine alone? Even the pillow on which I lie breathing as I float into my private midnight dream bears traces of duck down, polyester, and cotton, and the environments from which this pillow was manufactured, as well as of the traffic of mites sharing the pillow with me. I have come to believe that the concept of a walled garden of isolation refers to no actual reality. It is a necessary fantasy for intensifying communication with invisibles, whose omens and hints are so dimly perceived. The idea of unshared provides a gate into the garden of individuality. We need the idea to confirm our private sense of uniqueness and to hear its call. The category unshared environment is an invention of the hard sciences to locate the cause of individual differences. It is used to explain what cannot be accounted for by their other categories, heritability and shared environment. But the idea unshared rests on an image of enclosure, of a private surrounding that affects me alone in a particular way. The only possible unshared and unshareable phenomenon that is always around and impinging on my life is the uniqueness of the daimon, and the individuality of my relation with it, and it with me. By using the language of behavioral science, disguised in the circumlocutions of unshared environment, the daimon shows itself to be a determinant on equal footing with nature and nurture. How else enter the secured strictures of the lab except in the language of the lab and by means of the password unshared? Unshared does not mean isolated, for there is no way out of the shared environment which is this planet. And although there is no isolation, there is indeed uniqueness. The first is not necessary for the second. You don't have to be literally sealed away in order to be different. Your difference from every other person, the unshared experience, occurs every moment within the shared, because of the uniqueness of your individual identity. Your difference doesn't require walls for its guarantee. This guarantee was given from the beginning by the image in your heart that accompanies you through your life. A fantasy of isolation, however, may be useful for attending to the daimon. Hence, people take retreats, go on vision quests, fast and purge, or simply stay in bed in the dark for a few days to recover their particular unshared calling. The upshot of genetic studies leads in two directions, a narrow path and a broad one. The narrow road heads toward simplistic, monogenic causes. It wants to pinpoint bits of tissue and correlate them with the vast complexity of psychic meanings. The folly of reducing mind to brain never seems to leave the Western scene. We can never give it up because it is so basic to our Western rationalist and positivist mindset. The rationalist in the psyche wants to locate causes you can put your hands on and fix. Machines provide the best models for meeting this desire. Take them apart, find their inner mechanisms, and then adjust their functioning by modifying their ratchets, enriching their fuel, greasing their connections. Henry Ford as father of American mental health. Result: Ritalin, Prozac, Zoloft, and dozens of other effective products for internal adjustment that we consume in abundance, millions of us, daily or twice daily. The simplistics of monogenic causes eventually leads to the control of behavior by drugs, that is, to drugged behavior. Robert Plomin, on whose passionate, prolific, and perceptive writings this chapter has frequently relied, urgently warns against using genetics in a simplistic manner. He states, "Genetic effects on behavior are polygenic and probabilistic, not single gene and deterministic." I gather from him a warning to psychiatry. Do not capsize your noble vessel under the weight of pharmaceutical, insurance company, and government gold. And do not set your compass toward Fantasy Island, where genetics will define disease entities in psychiatry. We have learned little about the genetics of development, how genes act and interact over time, except to appreciate its complexity. Therefore, we can never arrive at that equation where one defective gene equals one clinical picture, except for true anomalies like Huntington's chorea. These warnings have little effect. Simplistic thinking fulfills too many wishes. The heads of Henry Ford and Thomas Edison are carved into the Mount Rushmore of the mind. The monster of mechanism appears in every century of modern Western history and must be watched for by each generation, especially ours, when to hold out for something else besides nature or nurture means believing in ghosts or magic. Ever since French rationalism of the 17th, Marin Mersenne, Nicolas de Malebranche, and 18th, Étienne de Condillac, Julien Nofoy de la Mettrie, centuries, and right through to the positivism of the 19th, Antoine d'Estoutes de Tracy, Auguste Comte, in which all mental events were reduced to biology, a piece of the collective Western mind has been yoked like a dumb ox to the heavy tumbril of French mechanistic materialism. It is astounding how a people with such subtle taste as the French, and with such erotic sensibility, can go on and on, contributing so much rationalist rigor mortis to psychology. Every import that arrives from France must be inspected for this French disease, even though it carries the fashionable label of Lacanism, structuralism, deconstruction, or whatever. Today, rationalism is global, computer-compatible everywhere. It is the international style of the mind's architecture. We cannot pin it to a particular flag, unless to the banners of the multinational corporation that can spend big bucks turning psychiatry and, eventually, psychological thinking, and therefore soul control, toward monogenetic monotheism. One gene for one disorder. Splice the gene, teach it tricks, combine it, and the disorder is gone, or at least you don't know you have it. The narrow path leads back to the 30s and 40s of psychiatric history, though in a more refined manner, and with better press releases. From 1930 into the 1950s, correlating specific brain areas with large emotional and functional concepts provided the rationale for the violence of psychosurgery and the lobotomizing of many a troubled soul at odds with circumstance. The narrow path is yet more retro, going back to the skull analysis of Franz Josef Gall, M.D., Vienna, 1795, who settled in Paris and was much appreciated by the French. From him came the evidence that skull bumps and declivities could be correlated with psychological faculties, a system later called phrenology. Much as they are today, the faculties were given big names, such as memory, judgment, emotionalism, musical and mathematical talent, criminality, and so on. Refinement in methods over the years does not necessarily lead to progress in theorizing. 1795 or 1995, material location and then reduction of psyche to location prompts the enterprise. The contrary direction to narrowing nature to brain simplistics is expanding nurture to a far more embracing notion of environment. If environment means literally what's around, it must also mean whatever is around. This because the unconscious psyche selects quite arbitrarily among the stuff encountered every day in the environment. Tiny and trivial bits of information may have huge subliminal psychic effects, as the day's residues in dreams show. We do dream of the damnedest things. Much of each day is never noticed or recalled, but the psyche picks up the environmental flotsam and delivers it to the dream. The dream, a processing plant recycling the environment, finding soul values in junk. The dream, an artist, appropriating images from the environment for recollection in tranquility. Because we walk about in fields of psychic realities that influence our lives, we have to broaden the notion of environment in terms of deep ecology, the hypothesis that the planet is a living, breathing, and self-regulating organism. Since anything around can nourish our souls by feeding imagination, there is soul stuff out there. So why not admit, as does deep ecology, that the environment itself is ensouled, animated, inextricably meshed with us, and not fundamentally separate from us? The ecological vision restores to environment also the classical idea of providentia, that the world provides for us, looks out for us, even looks after us. It wants us around too. Predators, tornadoes, and black flies in June are only pieces of the picture. Just think of all that's delicious and sweet-smelling. Do birds sing but for each other? This breathable, edible, and pleasant planet, invisibly serviced and maintained, keeps us all by means of its life support system. Such would be an idea of nurture that is truly nurturing. Environment, then, would be imagined well beyond social and economic conditions, beyond the entire cultural setting to include every item that takes care of us every day, our tires and coffee cups and door handles and the book you are holding in your hands. It becomes impossible to exclude this bit of environment as irrelevant, in favor of that bit as significant, as if we could rank world phenomena in order of importance. Important for whom? Our understanding of importance itself has to change. Instead of important to me, think of important to other aspects of the environment. Does this item nurture what else is around, not merely us who are around? Does it contribute to the intentions of the field, of which we are only one short-lived part? As notions of environment shift, we notice environment differently. It becomes more and more difficult to make a cut between psyche and world, subject and object. In here and out there, I can no longer be sure whether the psyche is in me or whether I am in the psyche as I am in my dreams, as I am in the moods of the landscapes and the city streets, as I am in music heard so deeply that it is not heard at all, but you are the music while the music lasts. T.S. Eliot. Where does the environment stop and I begin? And can I begin at all without being in some place, deeply involved in, nurtured by the nature of the world? Chapter 7. Penny Dreadfuls and Pure Fantasy. How do we select the right nutrients for the acorn? How can we judge what is a waste of time? Is there health food for the soul? In the good old days, values were established and directions from them clear. There was standard stuff to study. A canon, today renamed the core curriculum, not only in the basic three R's, but also in drawing, elocution, music appreciation, nature studies. The minds of very small children were guided, or drilled, whether in the direction of reason or of aesthetic imagination. John Stuart Mill, the 19th century philosopher whom we know today mainly for his utilitarianism and his ideas of liberty, never attended school. Educated at home by his father, he began learning Greek at 3 and Latin at 8, and by 14 had read most of the major ancient texts in the original. Another wondrous example of 19th century education was the Anglo-Irish mathematician William Rowan Hamilton. At 3, he was a superior reader of English and considerably advanced in arithmetic. At 5, he loved to recite yards of Homer in Greek. At 8, he added a mastery of Italian and French, and extemporized fluently in Latin. By 13, William was able to brag that he had mastered one language for each year he had lived. This demonic appetite for language took him through Persian, Arabic, Sanskrit, Chaldee, Malay, Bengali. And he is about to commence the Chinese, wrote his uncle, complaining of the cost of providing the books for his ravenous nephew. Francis Galton, who pioneered the study of genius, and was yet another of these freak Victorian masterminds, could read by the time he was 2½, sign his name before 3, and wrote this letter to his sister before he was 5. My dear Adele, I am 4 years old and can read any English book. I can say all the Latin substantives and adjectives and active verbs, besides 52 lines of Latin poetry. I can cast up any sum in addition and multiply by 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10. I can also say the pence table. I read French a little, and I know the clock. Francis Galton, February 15, 1827. Nearer to our day, in time only, but just as distant in spirit as Galton and Mill, is the punishment meted out to Dorothy Thompson by her Methodist minister father. Thompson, born a century ago, was once named by Time magazine the most influential woman in America, next to Eleanor Roosevelt. She was a persuasive liberal journalist, the first American woman to head a foreign news bureau, and the first correspondent to be expelled from Germany by personal order of Hitler. In her columns and broadcasts, she reached millions for years, taking on the right wing, the Republicans, the anti-Semites, the fascists, and Clare Boothe Luce with courage, skill, and much learning. Once, when she slapped her little sister, her father locked her in a closet and would not let her out until she could recite Shelley's Adonais from beginning to end. By the time she was grown, Dorothy could deliver without pause whole chapters of the Bible, the sonnets of Shakespeare, great chunks of Leaves of Grass, Chesterton's Lepanto, dozens of the Psalms, and the entire Constitution of the United States. The kind of punishment, though decreed by her father and decidedly cruel and unusual by today's educational standards, seems to have been chosen by her own protective daimon, who had, of course, anyway selected that particularly literary father. The memorizing of texts fit the pattern of her life of writing among such colleagues as Alexander Wolcott, Rebecca West, H.L. Mencken, and Thompson's own husband, the Nobel Prize-winning writer Sinclair Lewis. Mill, Hamilton, Galton, and Thompson are exceptions only in their early mastery, not with respect to the materials mastered. From Plato, who insisted upon music as essential to the canon, through the Stoics and Sophists, from the Catholics, especially the Jesuits, the Orthodox Jews, and Philip Melanchthon, whose ambition it was to educate Protestant Germany, to Rousseau and Froebel with their romantic programs, and on up to Rudolf Steiner and Maria Montessori, there have always been strong recommendations in the European tradition for an authorized program to prevent the young mind from wasting itself on trivia. The inner life of the mind, whether endowed innately or merely a tabula rasa, needed to be correctly nourished in its full range, not only by means of logic and mathematics, but also by addressing its ethical character and imaginative powers. Therefore, many recommendations have been less strictly mental and less literate, but just as dogmatically enforced. Hands to be kept busy, play restricted or supervised, no idleness, chores finished, construction, make things, tinker, sew, learn crafts, do repairs and maintenance, manners at table, in dress, in hygiene, with neighbors. Language was disciplined so the child would be well-spoken. Moral instruction from the religious who ministered to the soul with Bible, hymns, and homilies. And certainly not least, especially for the romantics from Rousseau through Steiner, was the instruction of nature, the soul's primordial nutrient drawn from fields, flowers, and farmyards, and from the coasts and headlands of rocks and tidal pools, sea sounds, and the winds. Edith Cobb's The Ecology of Imagination in Childhood makes it clear that the poetic basis of mind needs the nourishment given by the phenomena of nature. Imagination cannot come into its own without immersion in the natural world, or at least without occasional contact with its wonders. John Lennon, for instance, a city boy, visited Scotland at the very beginning of adolescence, and while out for a walk one day he lapsed into a trance. The ground starts going beneath you and the heather, and I could see this mountain in the distance, and this kind of feeling came over me. I thought, this is that one they're always talking about, the one that makes you paint or write because it's so overwhelming that you have to tell somebody, so you put it into poetry.